3. With the oncoming of spring, there begins in every culture an economic life of settled form. Footnote. We know this accurately for the Egyptian and the Gothic beginnings, and in general terms for the Chinese and the classical. As for the economic pseudomorphosis of the Arabian, it may be summarized after Hadrian as a process of disintegration of the highly civilized classical money economy, culminating in the appearance, under Diocletian, of a springtime barter economy with, in the East, the true Magian element of bargaining visibly superposed. End of footnote. The life of the population is entirely that of the peasant on the open land. The experience of the town has not yet come. All that elevates itself from amongst the villages, castles, palaces, monasteries, temple closes, is not a city, but a market, a mere meeting point of yeomen's interests, which also acquired, and at once, a certain religious and political meaning, but certainly cannot be said to have had a special life of its own. The inhabitants, even though they might be artisans or traders, would still feel as peasants, and even in one way or another work as such. That which separates art from a life in which everyone is alike producer and consumer is goods, and traffic in goods is the mark of all early intercourse, whether the object be brought from the far distance or merely shifted about within the limits of the village or even the farm. A piece of goods is that which adheres, by some quiet threads of its essence, to the life that has produced it or the life that uses it. A peasant drives his cow to market. A woman puts away her finery in the cupboard. We say that a man is endowed with this world's goods. The word possession takes us back right into the plant-like origin of property, into which this particular being, no other, has grown from the roots up. Exchange in these periods is a process whereby goods pass from one circle of life into another. They are valued with reference to life according to a sliding scale of felt relation to the moment. There is neither a conception of value, nor a kind or amount of goods that constitutes a general measure. For gold and coin are goods too, whose rarity and indestructibility causes them to be highly prized. Footnote. Neither the copper pieces of the Italian Villanova graves of early Homeric times, nor the early Chinese bronze coins in the form of women's drapery, pu, bells, rings, or knives, tsien, are described as money, but quite distinctly symbols of goods. And the coins struck by the governments of early Gothic times, in imitation of the classical, as signs of sovereignty, figured in economic life only as wares. A piece of gold is worth as much as a cow, but not vice versa. End of footnote. Into the rhythm and course of this barter, the dealer only comes as an intervener. Footnote. Hence it is that so often he is not an outcome of the fixed and self-contained life of the countryside, but an alien appearing in it, an alien having neither importance nor antecedents. This is the role of the Phoenicians in the earliest period of the classical, of the Romans in the East in Mithridates' time, of the Jews, and with them the Byzantines, Persians, and Armenians in the Gothic West, of the Arabs in the Sudan, of the Indians in East Africa, and of the West Europeans in present-day Russia. End of footnote. In the market, the acquisitive and the creative economics encounter one another, but even at places where fleets and caravans unload, trade only appears as the organ of countryside traffic. Footnote. And consequently on a very small scale. As foreign trade was in those days highly adventurous and appealed to the imagination, it was as a rule immensely exaggerated. The great merchants of Venice and the Hansa about 1300 were hardly the equals of the more distinguished craftsmen. The turnover of even the Medici or the Fuga about 1400 was equivalent to that of a shop business in a small town today. The largest merchant vessels, in which usually several traders held part shares, were much smaller than modern German river barges and made only one considerable voyage each year. The celebrated wool export of England, a main element of Hanseatic trade, amounted about 1270 to hardly as much as the contents of two modern goods trains. End of footnote. It is the eternal form of economy, and is even today seen in the immemorially ancient figure of the peddler of the country districts remote from towns, and in out-of-the-way suburban lanes where small barter circles form naturally, and in the private economy of savants, officials, and in general everyone not actively part of the daily economic life of the great city. With the soul of the town, a quite other kind of life awakens. As soon as the market has become the town, it is no longer a question of mere centres for goods streams traversing a purely peasant landscape, but of a second world within the walls, for which the merely producing life out there is nothing but object and means, and out of which another stream begins to circle. The decisive point is this: the true urban man is not a producer in the prime terrene sense. He has not the inward linkage with soil or with the goods that pass through his hands. He does not live with these, but looks at them from outside and appraises them in relation to his own life upkeep. With this, goods become wares, exchange, turnover, and in place of thinking in goods, we have thinking in money. With this, a purely extensional something, a form of limit-defining, is abstracted from the visible objects of economics, just as mathematical thought abstracts something from the mechanistically conceived environment. Abstract money corresponds exactly to abstract number. Both are entirely inorganic. The economic picture is reduced exclusively to quantities, whereas the important point about goods had been their quality. For the early period peasant, his cow is first of all just what it is, a unit being, and only secondarily an object of exchange. But for the economic outlook of the true townsman, the only thing that exists is an abstract money value, which at the moment happens to be in the shape of a cow that can always be transformed into that of, say, a banknote. Even so, the genuine engineer sees in a famous waterfall not a unique natural spectacle, but just a calculable quantum of unexploited energy. It is an error of all modern money theories that they start from the value token, or even the material of the payment medium, instead of from the form of economic thought. Footnote. Marks and dollars are no more money than meters and grams are forces. Pieces of money are real values. It is only our ignorance of classical physics that has saved us from confusing gravitation with a pound weight. In our mathematics, with its classical basis, we still mix number with magnitude, and our imitation of classical coinage has brought about the same confusion between money and pieces of money. End of footnote. In reality, money, like number and law, is a category of thought. There is a monetary, just as there is a juristic and a mathematical and a technical thinking of the world around. From the sense experience of a house, we obtain quite different abstracts, according as we are mentally appraising it from the point of view of a merchant, a judge, or an engineer, and with reference to a balance sheet, a lawsuit, or a danger of collapse. Next of kin to thinking in money, however, is mathematics. To think in terms of business is to calculate. The money value is a numerical value measured by a unit of reckoning. Footnote. Conversely, therefore, we can call the metric system, centimeters, grams, a valuation, and in fact all money measures proceed from the weight theories of physics. End of footnote. This exact value in itself, like number in itself, the man of the town, the man without roots, is the first to imagine. For peasants, there are only ephemeral felt values in relation to now this and now that object of exchange. What he does not use, or does not want to possess, has no value for him. Only in the economy picture of the real townsman are there objective values and kinds of values which have an existence apart from his private needs, as thought elements of a generalized validity, although in actuality every individual has his proper system of values and his proper stock of the most varied kinds of value, and feels the ruling prices of the market as cheap or dear with reference to these. Footnote. Similarly, all value theories, however objective they're meant to be, are developed, and inevitably so, out of a subjective principle. That of Marx, for example, defines value in the way that promotes the interest of the manual worker, the effort of the discoverer or the organizer seeming to him therefore valueless. But it would be wrong to describe this as erroneous. All these theories are right for their supporters and wrong for their opponents, and it is not reasons but life that settles whether one is a supporter or an opponent. End of footnote. Whereas the earlier mankind compares goods, and does so not by means of the reason only, the later reckons the values of wares, and does so by rigid, unqualitative measures. Now gold is no longer measured against the cow, but the cow against the gold, and the result is expressed by an abstract number, the price. Whether and how this measure of value finds symbolic expression in a value sign, as the written, spoken, or represented number sign is, in a sense, number, depends on the economic style of the particular culture, each of which produces a different sort of money. The common condition for the appearance of this is the existence of an urban population that thinks economically in terms of it, and it is its particular character that settles whether the value token shall serve also as payment medium. Thus, the classical coin, and probably the Babylonian silver, did so serve, whereas the Egyptian deben, raw copper weighed out in pounds, was a measure of exchange, but neither token nor payment medium. The Western and the contemporary Chinese banknote, the Western introduced on a very modest scale by the Bank of England from the end of the 18th century, the Chinese dating from the period of the contending states, again is a medium, but not a measure. In fact, we are accustomed to deceive ourselves thoroughly as to the role played by coins of precious metal in our sort of economy. They are just wares fashioned in imitation of the classical custom, and hence, measured against book values of credit money, they have a price. The outcome of this way of thinking is that the old possession, bound up with life and the soil, gives way to the fortune, which is essentially mobile and qualitatively undefined. It does not consist in goods, but it is laid out in them. Considered by itself, it is a purely numerical quantum of money value, and is thought of as amount, whereas we speak of the extent of a property in goods. As the seat of this thinking, the city becomes the money market, the centre of values, and a stream of money values begins to infuse, intellectualize, and command the stream of goods. And with this, the trader, from being an organ of economic life, becomes its master. Thinking in money is always, in one way or another, trade or business thinking. It presupposes the productive economy of the land, and therefore is always primarily acquisitive, for there is no third course. The very words acquisition, gain, speculation point to a profit tricked off from the goods en route to the consumer, an intellectual plunder, and for that reason are inapplicable to the early peasantry. Only by attuning ourselves exactly to the spirit and economic outlook of the true townsman can we realize what they mean. He works not for needs, but for sales, for money. The business view gradually infuses itself into every kind of activity. The countryman, inwardly bound up with traffic in goods, was at once giver and taker, and even the trader of the primitive market was hardly an exception to this rule. But with money traffic there appears, between producer and consumer, as though between two separate worlds, the third party, the middleman, whose thought is dominated a priori by the business side of life. He forces the producer to offer and the consumer to inquire of him. He elevates mediation to a monopoly and thereafter to economic primacy, and forces the other two to be in form in his interest, to prepare the wares according to his reckonings, and to cheapen them under the pressure of his offers. He who commands this mode of thinking is the master of money, even to the modern pirates of the money market who intervene amongst the interveners and gamble with money as wares. In all the cultures, evolution takes this road. Lysias informs us in his oration against the corn merchants that the speculators at the Piraeus frequently spread reports of the wreck of a grain fleet or of the outbreak of war in order to produce a panic. In Hellenistic Roman times, it was a widespread practice to arrange for land to go out of cultivation or for imports to be held in bond in order to force up prices. In the Egyptian New Empire, wheat corners in the American style were made possible by a bill discounting that is fully comparable with the banking operations of the West. Footnote. These trading forms of the Ptolemaic period were already in vogue and at the same high level under the 18th dynasty. End of footnote. Cleomenes, Alexander the Great's administrator for Egypt, was able, by book transactions, to get the whole corn supply into his own hands, thereby producing a famine far and wide in Greece, and raking in immense gains for himself. To think economically on any terms but these is simply to become a mere pawn in the money operations of the great city. This style of thought soon gets hold of the waking consciousness of the entire urban population, and therefore of everyone who plays any serious part in the conduct of economic history. Peasant and burgher stand not only for the difference of country and city, but for that of possessions and money as well. The splendid culture of Homeric and Provençal princely courts was something that waxed and waned with the men themselves. We can often, even today, see it in the life of old families in their country seats. But the more refined culture of the bourgeoisie, its comfort, is something coming from outside, something that can be paid for. Footnote. So also was the bourgeois ideal of freedom. In theory, and therefore constitutionally, a man may be free in principle, but actually in the economic private life of the cities, he is made free only by money. End of footnote. All highly developed economy is urban economy. World economy itself, the characteristic economy of all civilizations, ought properly to be called world city economy. The destinies, even of this world economy, are now decided in a few places, the money markets of the world. The name bourse can be applied even in other cultures, if by that word we mean the thought organ of a developed money economy. In Babylon, Thebes and Rome, in Byzantium and Baghdad, in London, New York, Berlin and Paris. The residue is a starveling provincial economy that runs on in its narrow circles without being conscious of its utter dependence. Finally, money is the form of intellectual energy in which the ruler will, the political and social, technical and mental, creative power, the craving for a full-sized life, are concentrated. Shaw is entirely right when he says, "The universal regard for money is the one hopeful fact in our civilization. The two things, money and life, are inseparable, Money is the counter that enables life to be distributed socially. It is life, from the preface to Major Barbara. What is here described as civilization, then, is the stage of a culture at which tradition and personality have lost their immediate effectiveness, and every idea to be actualized has to be put into terms of money. At the beginning, a man was wealthy because he was powerful. Now he is powerful because he has money. Intellect reaches the throne only when money puts it there. Democracy is the completed equating of money with political power. Through the economic history of every culture, there runs a desperate conflict waged by the soil-rooted tradition of a race, by its soul, against the spirit of money. The peasant wars of the beginning of a late period, in the classical 700 to 500, in the western 1450 to 1650, in the Egyptian end of Old Kingdom, are the first reaction of the blood against the money that is stretching forth its hand from the waxing cities over the soil. Stein's warning that he who mobilizes the soil dissolves it into dust points to a danger common to all cultures. If money is unable to attack possession, it insinuates itself into the thoughts of the noble and peasant possessors, until the inherited possession that has grown with the family's growth begins to seem like resources merely put into land and soil, and, so far as their essence is concerned, mobile. Footnote. The farmer is the man whose connection with the piece of land is no longer anything more than practical. End of footnote. Money aims at mobilizing all things. World economy is the actualized economy of values that are completely detached in thought from the land and made fluid. Extended footnote. The increasing intensity of this thinking appears in the economic picture as a growth of the available money mass, which is abstract and imagined and has nothing to do with the visible supply of gold as a ware. The stiffening of the money market, for example, is a purely intellectual process played out in the hands of a small handful of men. The increasing energy of money thinking consequently awakens in every culture the feeling that the value of money is going down. Enormously so, for example, in the time between Solon and Alexander, with reference namely to the unit of calculation. What actually happens is that the mercantile units of value have become artificial and no longer comparable with the primary and livingly experiential values of the peasant economy. In the end, it ceases to matter in what figures the Attic treasure of the Delian League, 454, or the sums involved in the peace treaties of 241 and 201, or the booty of Pompey in 64, are reckoned, and whether we ourselves shall pass in a few decades from the milliards, still unknown in 1850, but commonplace today, to the billions. There is no common standard for the value of a talent in 430 and in 30 BC, for gold, like cattle and corn, has continually altered not only its own numeration, but its significance within an ever-advancing urban economy. The only steady element is the fact that quantity of money, not to be confused with the stock of tokens and the means of payment, is an alter ego mirroring thought in money. End of extended footnote. The classical money thinking from Hannibal's day transformed whole cities into coin and whole populations into slaves, and thereby converted both into money that could be brought from everywhere to Rome and used outwards from Rome as a power. The Faustian money-thinking opens up whole continents, the water power of gigantic river basins, the muscular power of the peoples of broad regions, the coal measures, the virgin forests, the laws of nature, and transforms them all into financial energy, which is laid out in one way or in another, in the shape of press, or elections, or budgets, or armies, for the realization of masters' plans. Ever new values are abstracted from whatever world stock is still, from the business point of view, unclaimed. The slumbering spirits of gold, as John Gabriel Borkman says. And what the things themselves are, apart from this, is of no economic significance at all.